Hello?
Hello, this is Joy Wright.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome, and this is Dave Kruger. I hope we're all set for a really interesting seminar series. I look forward to this. Thank you, each of you, who have already sent answers to the questions about if I sat down today, right now, what would be the most important thing that I'd like to focus on, the most important question I have about this topic, and if I walk away in 4 weeks saying this is one of the best seminar series ever, what would I walk away with? So for those of you who haven't answered, what response do you have? If there's one most important thing to you right now about this topic of money mastery for yourself, your money story, and coaching in this area, what is it? Jump in, say your name and where you're from, and lay the question on the table, if you would. Anyone?
Hi, my name is Joy, and I'm from St. Louis, Missouri.
Yes,
and my first question.
You're sending your answers to those questions.
I did.
Okay. Now, again, we're looking at this from integrating the mind and brain sciences for understanding our relationship with money. This is not an investment piece about, you know, investments and growing money and all that, although I think this will be an outcome. So go ahead with that in mind and ask your question, because I know your questions had to do with investment things, and that's not what we do as coaches. And what I'm going to do is deal with this as we would be doing it in mentor coaching in our professional practice. So would you like to even slightly revise your most important question, Joy?
Sure. Based off of the itinerary for the next 4 weeks, I believe then the question would be how to rid oneself of previous money bad money thoughts or bad relationships with money.
Okay. All right. That's a very valid point. What we know, neuroscience has shown that over 90%, almost 95% of our operating system is unconscious. So the beliefs, the ways that we automatically create patterns of attachment, of emotion, of behavior, and even money behavior are things that we do so automatically we may not even be aware of. So I think that's a really important question, because the best way to change a habit is to look at the system, or the best way to create a new habit is to look at the system, not just the goal. You know, everybody wants more money. Everybody wants to do better, manage it better, create wealth, that sort of thing. That's not the issue. The issue is, how do you systematically go about that, or how do we help our clients do that? And the answer is not in information. Some of you who have collaborated with me before have heard me say, if information were enough, we'd all eat mostly vegetables, we'd work out every day, we'd be thin, we'd have a lot of money saved up for the future, there would be a bunch of librarians that would be billionaires. So it's not about information. It's really, in some ways, about understanding our relationship with money. A money story is not our income, expenses, assets, debt, or net worth. It's our relationship with money, the plot and the storylines a money autobiography. But that's what we're going to talk about in our first seminar, is to look at really conceptualizing a money story, and then in the remaining three seminars, we're going to look at how do we go about crafting change, a scientifically proven system of generating change and effectiveness in doing that. So thank you for boldly stepping up, Joy, and for your revision. I think that's important for what we're about. So, anybody else want to answer that? What's your most important question you'd like to ask or what you'd like to walk away with 4 weeks from now.
Dave, this is Carolyn. Hodge, I have you. Yeah, hi, how are you? Did the class start at 7? Did I get this wrong?
7 Eastern, yes. We just started like 5 minutes ago.
Okay, good.
Yeah, go ahead. Do you have a comment or question?
Yes, both. The reason I took the course is because I wanted to, I'm curious about the idea of being able to coach somebody else about money. And then I looked at the online and looked at the book, and you know, it was really interesting because it's very self-reflective to think about your relationship with money and what you do with it and how you see it and how you understand it, how you perceive it and understand it. And, you know, I started working at a very early age in my life, and I enjoy work. I love it, and I enjoy it. And I've had a lot of money, and I've had a little money. But what I would like to do is to I'm contemplating relocating, and I don't want money to be the barrier that keeps me from actually moving forward. So in addition to the classes that I'm taking with you, I think this is just going to be a really good complement to what I'm already doing. Because, you know, one of my colleagues said to me that I had to lose the, as she said, you have to lose the poverty mindset. That's what she said. And I was really too embarrassed to ask her what she meant because I was stunned that she said it. So that led me to take this course. I just want, you know, perhaps I have it, and if so, I want to get rid of it.
Well, I think that's excellent, and you've come to the right place because we know from quantum physics and neuroscience that we get what we focus on. So to lose a scarcity mindset or a poverty mindset would not be the best goal because the unconscious doesn't know the difference between positive or negative, just the focus. So the focus is on scarcity. The focus is on poverty. We'll talk about how to revise that so that all of you is going in the same direction. And what you point out, I think, is really important. Some time ago, when I was talking with an internationally known publisher about a money book, I was talking with him about The Secret Language of Money before that was published, and he said something so elegant and simple that I asked him if I could repeat it. He said, "You know, Dave, I don't know how to tell my money story to myself in order to know what to change." And that's exactly the dilemma that we all experience. Think about, you know, how do you tell your life story, your wellness story, your career story, your relationship story, your money story to yourself? Well, we're going to look at a systematic way to do that will apply to money story, but will work for other kinds of stories, and I think will be a real benefit for you in mentor coaching. And the first thing we want to do, in my view, is really come to understand and fulfill our own story. And once we do that, we're going to be in the very best position possible to work with clients and help them write their new stories. Not to ghostwrite it, but to be a catalyst for them developing their new stories in a totally informed way. So thanks, Carolyn, for that. I think that's so much on target. Other thoughts, other questions, other answers to either of those queries that I sent out? Victor, are you with us?
I am. I actually was about to ask a question.
Well, I'm a mind reader, Victor, among other things. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Thanks. So I am in the CTA coaching training, and I, you know, I'm understanding a little bit. This is kind of a little bit of ignorance because I'm at the beginning of this whole thing, you know, so I'm trying to make sense of it. I understand we don't consult nor give advice or anything. We ask questions, so I get that. So now I'm trying to figure out, like, with this training, say I understand this training well, I incorporate it myself. If I'm not allowed to use this, I shouldn't say allowed, but, you know, if I'm not using this to consult because that's not coaching, is this information going to help me frame my questions better to the client so they can incorporate? You get what I mean? Because I can't, like, use this to...
And that's understandable. That's a great question. In fact, let me tell you just a brief story about all the things that we do in coaching in addition to ask powerful questions. Now, I don't convey this so early in their training as you are in yours, it sounds like, to the students and people I train, but you'll have to deal with this since you ask it, okay? A number of years ago, I was asked to be a guest for a group of coaches, very seasoned coaches, had been in practice 5 or more years, really a terrific group of people, and they asked me to consult on a particular case that they were having trouble with and wanted me to, you know, do a group supervision and be a guest, and I readily agreed. I knew 3 or 4 of them, and I thought it would be fun. So they presented, at my request, the coach presented process notes, he said, she said. And what I noticed was the coach only asked powerful questions. Now, these were great questions, but the coach stuck to just questions. So the first thing I said when he got through, and after I thanked him for presenting and the openness and reassuring about the whole confidentiality issue, I said, "Now, you only ask powerful questions. Is that really what you do? Is that all you do?" And he, you know, kind of paused a bit and kind of, he said, "Well, no, not really." And then some of the other ones, coaches chimed in. Well, that's what, they were all trained by the same institute, a different institute, but they were trained, much as CTA does, about how important powerful questions are. And they said, "Well, this is what we were taught. You only ask powerful questions." And I said, "Is that really what all of you guys do?" And they said, "No." And they started talking about a number of other things. And I began to list off 8 or 9 things that I know that we do in mentor coaching in addition to asking powerful. We're going to get back to the topic of what we're supposed to be talking about in a minute, but I think this is an important question. Some of the things that we do in addition to asking powerful questions is that we story bust, we guide, we confront, we look at blind spots, we ask about additional information, we do any number of things. Sometimes we give information, sometimes we advise. One of my colleagues at CTA said, if you don't know what an AMWA is, you can't coach it out of somebody. So sometimes we simply give information or advice. That's why I call myself a mentor coach and work with professionals in training and practice. And I do that so that I don't have any qualms about doing whatever it takes for someone to be massively successful. And that may include giving information, acting like a Dutch uncle, giving advice, doing things that are important for the goal of the person. Now, lest I contaminate you, I want to add specifically, we remain loyal to the framework of coaching, in my view, and that it's a collaborative framework of looking together at developing the client story. We don't ghostwrite it. We don't tell somebody what they ought to do. We don't give advice in that way, but we help someone develop their own story. So whatever it takes to help them further that story, sometimes it's giving homework. Sometimes it's looking at any number of things that have to do with the success of the individual. Now, does that make sense to you, Victor?
It does, yeah. Thank you for that. I was wondering what mentor coach meant, because to me it's like I know what mentoring is and I'm learning what coaching, and I was like, what is the two together? Just kind of a synergy, you know, kind of like that someone who's experienced knows when to do mainly coaching and every now and then they know when to do the mentoring part. You know what I mean? Someone who's more seasoned and intuitively knows when to do one or the other, maybe.
Well, see, that's the beauty of making it up as you go along. I made up mentor coach. I'm sure I'm not the first one, but that means I get to say what it is. And I say what it is in terms of whatever is going to help my client to peak performance to massive success.
Okay.
So I think we probably ought to move into what we're supposed to be talking about. I'm going to put us on lecture mode, but I'm going to preserve some time at the end. I'll always preserve time at the end and the beginning for discussion. So anytime you have questions or comments or even a different point of view, please reserve them for those times and we'll talk. And remember the outline. It's a fairly annotated outline, so you don't have to take a bunch of notes. That's at the URL where the ports are for online playback. So we're recording this, and we'll do online playback. I'm going to go for the presentation part on lecture mode, so there's not background noise. You guys don't have to be concerned about that. But I'll come back with time, I'm hoping, for some discussion. Okay. You're each writing a story that you may not know how to tell. It's a very personal story with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but often not to you. It's a story that you talk about every day, think about several times a day, and is remarkably simple yet intricately complex. It's a story that has an internal and an external dialogue, a secret language, encrypted messages. And it's complicated because some important aspects are emotional, unspoken, even unconscious. This story is about the longest relationship you'll have in your life. Your parents discussed it before you arrived. People will deliberate it after you're gone. Maybe you'll get 10 years out of a car, maybe 40 or 50 with a spouse, but this story you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it, run away from it, or coax it into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you orient life decisions around it. You alone determine the genre, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of a life story, from what you eat and drink to what you plan and play. Health, recreation, stress, even the water you drink are all impacted. At times, you may have used this story to regulate your mood, adjust self-esteem, influence others, assuage emotional pains. And I think this is really important. How you live this story will be what you teach your children and your clients and your employees. What they see in your behavior and hear or sense even as your beliefs will be what they'll download as their own. The villain or hero, and this is the lifeline clue here, is the most popular legal substance to all peoples of the world. It speaks to you, and you speak with it. Of course, it's your money story. As Lauren Isley observed in The Unexpected Universe, reality has a way of hiding from even its most gifted observers. So let's consider a couple of money questions. One, what's your money story? And secondly, what would you ideally like your money story to be? So let's look at the first. Your money story is not your income, expenses, assets, debt, net worth. It's your relationship with money, the plot and storylines of your money autobiography. Your money story is the secret language of money at work. It's the unconscious tale you continually tell yourself about what you say with money, what money means to you, what you think money says about you. It's a running dialogue about how much you think you deserve, how much you think you're worth, how much you're capable of. It's also about what would happen if you had more and what would happen if you had less. So So let's look at some of the ways that we speak with money. Think about this for yourself, but also think about it in a parallel way, if that's not a burden, about listening to clients. So we speak with money first in a straightforward way. Money says whatever you tell it to. It can convey any message. Money can represent anything. It's a stand-in for what we idealize and desire, for what we fear and lack, even for what we covet or crave or chase or follow. We use money to show at times how much we care, at times how little. We use it to measure success and even try to buy happiness. We may use it to try to bolster self-esteem and influence others. In other words, we use it to communicate. Secondly, we speak with money as a tool. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value, build a relationship with it, make it bigger than it is. We use money to do any number of things that isn't about money at all. We use money as a self-statement, and money can make any statement. What people say and do are inevitable self-statements of their beliefs and their own reality. All you say is about yourself. A life story or money story manifests through self-statements. And of course, a story tells most about the teller. And think of these statements that are made as self-statements by people using money. Proclamation of freedom, currency of caring, promissory note for happiness, embodiment of power, evidence of security, proof of worth, license for opportunity, instrument of control. For example, we see a new car and want it. What we're really doing is playing out our money story. Just below our consciousness, we're adding a new plot line to our money story that may say something like, well, this car is going to show what I'm worth, or this is going to make people respect me, or this is going to validate me. Another obvious example is the self-statement of spending money. For example, conspicuous consumption is when you buy a red BMW 535 and drive it in the middle of a busy street. Contemptuous consumption is when you buy a red BMW 535 in the middle of a midlife crisis and drive it by your ex-wife's house. Now, that's not a self-statement for me. I'd never buy a red BMW. So, without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves and our lives. We use money in self-talk. The messages we tell ourselves, examples of these internal beliefs, and at times, self-talk. People who have significant money are lucky. People with money are different from me. You have to work really hard to make significant money. Truly spiritual people don't have money or wealth. Money really is going to buy happiness. Money means the same to everyone. An external dialogue about money. Part of what keeps the language of money a secret is the fact that it remains largely unspoken. Our social conventions create unusual pairings of spoken and unspoken agreements. We can speak of a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss the cost of plastic surgery, but not her age. We can debate financial markets and economies, but not personal income or debt. Ask the host of your next dinner party, how much money do you make? And you won't see the next dinner. Ask, what amount of debt do you have? And you probably won't see dessert. An agent at a writer's conference some time ago was discussing working with her authors over the years. I was in attendance. She talked about the details of some of her contract negotiations. This was an internationally known literary agent. She was well known for doing some very successful deals, and talks about some of the details of the negotiating of a contract. finally, somebody in the audience said, after things had evolved for a good while, would you talk about how much money's involved in the book deal so we can get an idea of what to expect? She looked a little shocked, and her immediate response was, well, I always felt you don't talk about money. And she was looking as if she were trying to compose herself. An older gentleman in the back row said, well, I thought once you finish the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of your sweatpants, and start selling your book. Well, of course he was right. His frankness and confrontation sparked a really lively discussion about money and contracts. The presenter revealed specific figures and went on to lead a discussion that was really useful to her audience interested in writing books for a living. Also think about the internal dialogue. We may not speak openly of something, but our inner voice never gives up the conversation. We have dialogues in our minds before making a decision to exchange our money, our time and energy, for something else. And every exchange involves two asking prices, financial and emotional. The conversation is often silent and automatic. It can have many dialects. It was a debate I had with myself, for example, in my first official job. At age 8, I earned 10 cents a row chopping cotton from my dad on hot summer days. This tells you how long ago this was. When I saw my class, and when school started, I saw my classmates the first day enjoying sodas and candies after lunch. I joined them, and my treats were gone quickly. And I immediately asked, was that candy worth half a row of chopping cotton? And will I get enough from this soft drink to pay one row of cotton chopping? I answered no right then to both of those questions. Now, this also helped me later look at and talk with my kids and then with clients about the cost of money, because we usually think about how to wisely allocate money. You know, we give our kids I gave my kids a clothes allowance for the year and then looked at allocating it and deciding how they were going to spend it, when they were going to spend it, and save part of it for later and all that. So all of that, but I'm talking about the cost of money, because money always costs, and that was an early lesson in that. Another example, at an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, I'll give you what I never had as a child. The preamble to spending may be to rationalize, well, this seems like a lot of money to pay for a big HD laser screen TV, but if I amortize it over the next 8 years, it only cost 17 cents a day. That's rationalized spending. And my wife said, Dave, if you want that TV, just go ahead and buy it. Another, we regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed frivolously. Gifted money can be spent without debate. Salary or professional fee money, after serious comparative choice, savings or retirement, relinquished only with definite need or emergency. Now, this is a framing bias. A dollar is a dollar. It doesn't know who owns it any more than war bonds knew about the war, but it's treated differently based on its context. And we attribute different meaning to that same dollar. So it becomes another example of how money is a Rorschach. We project our own issues, our own meaning onto that money. From a recent documentary, a woman on the verge of declaring her fourth bankruptcy said, well, the high from shopping is still more powerful than the low from bankruptcy. Or, finally, the parent who says, well, you know, I spend so much time at work when I'm off, I like to buy my child something to make up for it. A justification bias. A compromise occurs when there are two stories written simultaneously. the surface story that we're conscious of, that 5 or 10% of our operating system. I want to generate significant income and accumulate wealth. But if the shadow story says, and the shadow story may or may not be unconscious, well, I don't think I have what it takes. Or, you know, I'm really afraid that if I put everything into it and then still fail, I would be humiliated. Here's another example of a surface and shadow story that has to do with conflict. The surface story, I want to claim my freedom and become my own authority. The shadow story, well, I can't have total authority because my spouse acts like I'm taking it away when I do. So, let's look at how money speaks to us now. A study was done in which volunteers had their brain scanned using fMRI when they tasted 5 Cabernet Sauvignon. You know, as a sidebar here, I have some elaborate mechanisms to get research from around the world, correspond with some neuroeconomics and behavioral science labs, but I have never been able to find studies like this to volunteer for where you get to taste wine. The volunteers were told before tasting the price of each of the wines. They then rated the wines, as you might expect, according to price. They rated the most expensive one the best, and on down, the least expensive one as last. And their brains corresponded. The area of their brains that encode the pleasantness of an experience, the medial orbital frontal cortex, was more active with the more expensive wine. Actually, the volunteers tasted one wine with 5 different stories. They experienced more pleasure, and their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. A more recent study showed that people have, this is out of MIT, showed that people have better pain relief with a more expensive placebo than a less expensive placebo. Money sometimes communicates to us just below the level of our conscious awareness. It can speak to us as confidant, seducer, adversary, protector, or drug. Money serves as a tangible container for hope, freedom, ambition, love, disappointment, any number of other things. It's a Rorschach. So, I want you to write down your immediate single answer to these 3 questions. My current annual income. Write down a figure. Nobody's going to see it. Number 2, in order to ensure happiness and contentment financially, no more money problems and worries, my annual income would need to be what? Write down that figure. And the 3rd question, write down the first word that comes to mind. What money means to me is blank. First word that comes to mind. Now, I've given this quiz to hundreds of people over the years. I did it first with presentations that I did to executives and professionals when an earlier book in the early 90s came out, and then did it again with The Secret Language of Money. For more than 9, and would ask the audience, would send around index cards, guarantee anonymity, have them turn them face over, not indicate who they were, and pass them in that had them tallied. For over 90% of those who responded, their answers to the 1st and 2nd question indicate that they believe their annual income would need to be about twice the current level for them to feel happy and free of money worries. Someone who makes 50 grand a year thinks it would take roughly 100. Somebody who makes 500,000 thinks it would take about 1 million. And in follow-up studies, there's a trailing double. For somebody who made 100 thought it would take 200. When they got to 200 through good coaching, they then thought it would take about 400 until that was examined. So this emphasizes, I think, the idea of two things, of having a specific goal, because you never know you arrive when you don't, and that more is not a goal. More is a goal like perfect. You never get it. In fact, the very first introduction I had to people's money stories were psychoanalytic patients who were fortunate enough to make significant money, but then also insightful enough to recognize that what they thought would make them happy, you know, when I finally get to 5 million, when I finally get to 10 million, they realized they weren't happy and that more had not done it, despite some doubling. So they decided, well, I may as well see a shrink and see if there's something else going on. So this is something just to think about. There's no end point of wanting more. There's no limit to what you don't have. When you focus on more, on what you don't have, you ensure dissatisfaction. So let's look at your answer to the third question, what money means to me. There are a number of money equations of how we're wired to give money meaning without even thinking about it. Worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power. Now, think about if you're doing couples coaching and there are some money issues, think about how if one partner has a brain wired to have money means freedom, and the other partner's brain wiring is that money equals security. So when money means freedom, then enjoyment is spending money, enjoying what we do, living our life to the fullest. When money equals security, the joy and the pleasure is saving money, of creating and amassing wealth. So two very different surface stories there and wirings that will need to be negotiated in moving forward to co-create a common story. People may think money is a reflection of their self-worth. Are there morals even? One woman said, you know, I don't know why money's getting the best of me. I have good morals. I shouldn't have money problems. Well, money isn't related to morals. Action can get you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency keeps your money. Are there ethics even? President Obama said, if you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor. Now, we know better than that now. You may work hard, but overspend, gamble, have 5 kids, 3 of whom of college age, live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, or have a shopping addiction. Now, here's a question for you to think about. Who do you think in America has the best work ethic of all people, group, cultures, jobs, races, religion? Who do you think in America has the best work ethic? Think about it for just a minute. I've had guesses when I've done a workshop here in Houston, you know, shrimp boat workers, farmers. Are you ready? The best work ethic in America, the answer, heroin addicts. They get up every morning with a hustle, 7 days a week, holidays, 365 days a year. They cannot let a single day go by without working. And it's not because their self-esteem suffers. Here's how one heroin addict put it. If I don't get up early every morning and hustle all day, the next day I'll die. So I emphasize that for you to think about the difference between work ethic, which means being at your desk, showing up, working 8 or 10 hours a day, and performance ethic, and even especially success ethic. So what we do in mentor coaching is to look at enhancing performance and the pursuit and attainment of success for each individual, not how many hours a day they work. So why do we make these money errors? Well, the more we give money meaning, the more we focus, more we lose focus on what money really means. And then we do some strange things with money. Let me give you some examples. Intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people get scammed sometimes repeatedly. I have worked with Madoff victims. And a buddy of mine, Jeanine Roth, who's a multiple New York Times bestseller, has written a book about her experience of being a Madoff victim. And, you know, I'll mention a bit more about that book in just a moment. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Gifted people may not be able to convert their talent into sufficient income. Otherwise balanced individuals spend extravagantly or hoard compulsively. Otherwise dependable people can ignore financial matters until they're serious. Highly principled individuals can step over boundaries or write their own rules. Others are taught from the beginning. Burton Watson, CEO of CyberNet, conned investors out of $120 million. As a boy, Burton's mother would tell him, exceptionally wealthy and exceptionally intelligent people don't have to follow the rules. Burton listened to his mama. The messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories that imprison them until they're listened to and strategically changed. That's what our next three seminars are going to be about. Money has become more abstract. The vast majority of our money management occurs not through our hands, our broker's hands, but inside our minds, in a complex interplay of thoughts, emotions, neurological wiring, as part of that operating system that, by and large, is unconscious. So here's a 22-second history of how money has become more abstract. First, a couple of goats were exchanged for 5 bags of rice. Then, coins enter as a symbol of value, a unit of exchange. Coins were replaced by paper bills, then paper checks, then plastic, then a pure abstraction of numbers stored and traded as configurations of electrons. My last transaction was a wire transfer from bank to bank. I assume it happened. I see evidence it did. As money becomes more abstracted, transitions are easier, but our understanding of money may fade, and our relationship with it changes. So, here's a question. What's the role of the mind and brain in money behaviors and financial decisions? The answer, everything. So, let's look in a beginning wave. Why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will somebody repeat behavior when it doesn't work, often do it harder, and expect a different result, even if it leads maybe to lower energy or debt or plateaued careers or disappointing relationships? Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So, part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. Now, a comfort zone may be limiting or even uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's our default model. We repeat because we know how it will turn out, and that creates the illusion of effectiveness, predictability. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation, even anxiety. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map that's synonymous with identity. We tend to return to our default mode. Let's do a brief exercise. Some of you have done this with me before. Put your palms together and interlock your fingers very firmly and hold your palms in that interlocked position very firmly. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, very firmly held, but change so that your thumbs are reversed. The other thumb is on top. How's that feel? Kind of goofy, kind of awkward? Now, move your thumbs back to their original position. That's why people don't change, or why they don't succeed remarkably, or derail when they do, they return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, like a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to program change. There is always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Every client, every step of change, yourself included, as you know. Now, the other part of that answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotherapist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a really circuitous, zigzag, indirect turns path. He noticed that every person who followed him followed in that same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well worn. Even though it was really circuitous and indirect, not a single person started a new, more direct route. He did this subsequently on other days when it would be fresh snow, and did it increasingly diabolical with more twists and turns, more circuitous. Not a single person ever created a new, more direct route. To think creatively, neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. This is how pathways get laid down in our brain, like those pathways in the snow. We do things from early on. We incorporate models of how to be attached to others, how to behave, how to feel, including about money. And those pathways get repeated, even though they may be less direct and inefficient. Now, stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. Exactly what we do as coaches. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, a new context, looking at things from a different level. Exactly what we do as mentor coaches. And we're going to talk about this juncture in particular when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar and engage new behavior. The uncertainty of this newness can be read as anxiety equals danger, better head for cover, evidence not to proceed, even intuition of a wrong choice. Or, with the help of you, their coach, it can be read, reframed, as a signpost of change and progress, as validation that someone is in new territory. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism. It's located really close to the emotional center that says this isn't normal when we try something new. We'll talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. We struggle to embrace change. Many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work, though. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. Our money stories tell us less about money and more about the human mind and its operations. At times, both our minds and our brains can work against us. When you think with one part of the brain and feel with another, you need a map. So we're going to incorporate some groundbreaking research from different disciplines with strategic coaching to understand resistance to change and to guide strategies of change and success. So, how do we get our brains to work with us in creating new money stories? Well, our brain has a mind of its own, and we are of two or more minds. Neuroscientists study the responses and functioning of the brain by functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, a video of the brain in action, and it responds to different situations. These studies have disproven long-standing assumptions that people have a consistent and predictable and rational set of pressure, preferences, and responses. It debunks the idea that we choose logically. This is what behavioral economics is all about. Different parts of the brain operate in radically different ways. So money behavior and financial decisions are linked to both mind dynamics and brain activities. We're going to use these findings to inform certain decisions. Here's a glimpse, a précis of some examples. The prefrontal cortex says, well, let's think about the 12-month game plan and about a system for retirement savings. But the limbic system says, relax, let's have a cognac and order that 27-inch iMac. My amygdala even specifies the brand of cognac and can do the amazing task of pairing it with just the right cigar. Another, each part struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. So emotions do not simply and only corrupt decision-making, but emotions narrow attention and compress focus on the immediate, and compare that with people who feel no emotion and do not incorporate emotion, make lousy decisions. It's a balance. Making people happy is not simply giving them more what they prefer. The brain's pleasure center quickly accommodates to new stimuli and expects it to continue. In fact, David Geffen said, anybody who believes that money makes you happy doesn't have money. Now, and when someone's stock portfolio does well, they may impute this to their talent and their smartness. And it could be. Gamblers interpret good fortune as skill. Let me give you a brief example. My wife and I play heads-up poker, and she finally confessed that one of my tells is when I happen to draw a really lucky hand, I have a slightly smug look, like I think I'm brilliant. Well, I know she's right. The important thing about your money story is to discern what works and what doesn't work. The components that work don't need fixing. The ones that don't work need to be revised in order to enhance both your money and your life stories, and especially to discern what's really about money and what hitchhikes on money. And the answer to that is most of the things that seem to be about money are really what's hitchhiking on money. Your life can be changed significantly, though, by changing your money story. And money's a magnifier. Like adversity, it reveals character. Whoever a person is, excess money will exaggerate. If a person's a problem drinker, money will make them more drunk. If somebody's insecure, money will make them more paranoid. If someone's caring and generous, money can help them become a better philanthropist. And this is something just as a sidebar here. One of the chapters in a new training and book I'm working on about stress mastery and peak performance is something I've seen consistently and see more and more of. People who deal with exceptional success have a greater challenge than when people deal with exceptional struggles. You know, it seems like, you know, when somebody's got feeling bad down, the greatest challenge they're going to have is with feeling good. And so with exceptional success, I'm talking about exceptional fortune, exceptional fame, exceptional accomplishments. The greatest challenge they have is regulation, and we're going to talk about that as one of the roadmap steps. So in summary now, I want to say a few minutes. The most fundamental understanding about our relationship with money is not a depth understanding of money or finances. It's about understanding how our minds and brains work and how that affects our behavior, including about money. The beliefs and decisions and seemingly inexplicable behavior involving money isn't really about money at all. Money is a portal to the immaterial and the intangible. So, as a group now, we began a collaborative journey to understand the choice architecture of your money story. You write your money story, live it, can revise it, and write an informed, powerful new money story. Okay, we're in discussion mode now, if you'll manage background noise. Mute star 6 and then be sure and come off mute star 6 for anything that you want to comment or ask about. Thoughts, questions about anything we've talked about? Any clarifications first? Is this all making sense to you? Sort of.
This is Victor. It is making sense. I did have a question, if I may. It's what you mentioned at the end, because I was thinking about this earlier today. I don't know if the right word is success, anti-climax, but, like, just the idea behind when someone's successful, I was thinking about this. Is it because, like, you know, the dopamine receptors or cells are so intense and heightened and feeling good because they're successful, and it's like we feel like we have to do something to match that intensity physically, you know, for the sake of our continuity, you know? It's just like, you get what I mean? It's like handling it, and you feel like you got to go do something, like, extreme or intense now. You get what I mean?
You've been reading me, haven't you, Victor? Yes. success, anti-climax is a great way to say it, because one of the greater challenges with success is how you handle that afterwards. Because think about how when something has a sustained buildup, you're practicing, you're anticipating, that always boots up dopamine, the pleasure chemical. That's what keeps mm-hmm. us going. That's what keeps us reading a book, for example. You know, Stephen King said the most important thing that a writer can do is always have the reader wondering what's next. By wondering what's next, that boots up dopamine. So whenever that's the sprint system. No matter how long it is, it's still the sprint system because it's the exciting anticipation. Now, when something happens, we move to a totally different neurochemical system mediated by norepinephrine. So that reads as, this is what I expected. This is way less. No, it's not meant to be. The marathon system is not meant to be exciting. It's meant to get you through all those miles. So mm-hmm. this is something that I'll bet each of you have seen perhaps in the following way. Buyer's remorse, something you've been anticipating, really excited about for a long time. Then when you get it, it's not quite as exciting as you thought it might be. Or think about your client who may plateau at a month or two. They've anticipated all this. They've talked about all the things they know, and they're expecting neat things. But then all of a sudden they have to settle in and move to the marathon system of the hard, strategic, collaborative work. And it doesn't feel the same way, so they wonder, is this all there is? Or you'll hear, well, you know, I'm thinking about taking a break. So you want to ladder success, shrink the change, the next step, look at the steps of success, so there's always a success daily, weekly, monthly, so that you're taking this into account. In fact, probably the most dramatic illustration of what Victor just mentioned is after the very last race, after over a decade of practicing, competing, and the last race of the Olympics, the last race Bruce Jenner knew that he would ever run, the next morning he asked, what do I do now? He had absolutely no clue about the rest of his life because he had been doing one thing that was exciting and sustaining for essentially all of his adult life and much of his life total. So that's a great question. You know, thanks for asking that. I know we've got just about a minute. Any other thoughts or questions or comments? Well, whatever we didn't cover, and for those of you who I got an email from some who said they would not be able to attend the first but are going to jump in on the second, when you listen to this and as you reflect on it, jot down any questions you have or any comments you have, and we'll have a discussion period at the beginning of our next seminar. And remember, it will be posted within about 24 hours, probably less, by the CTA IT guy, who's also my IT guy, Bill. So it will be available for online playback. So thanks very much for your energy, for participation, and the ideas and questions you sent in. Look forward to picking up with you right here next time. Have a great rest of the week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye for now.